Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for downloading, and I sure hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on January 21st of 2024 under the headline "Japanese Sub Blasted Its Way into Oregon History." It's part one of a two-part presentation on the most important Imperial Japanese Navy submarine in Oregon state history, the legendary I-25, perpetrator of the shelling of Fort Stevens, the firebombing of the forest near Brookings, and a couple other hostile acts on behalf of the Japanese Empire during World War II. Part two will be on the podcast tomorrow morning. Now let's do part one. In late August 1943, the crew of the destroyer USS Patterson scrambled to battle stations off the coast of what is now Vanuatu, near Australia. The sonar operator had picked up the signature of a big Japanese submarine submerging close by. The Patterson steamed into battle, depth charges rolling off the deck and lighting up the sea below, and then on the final depth charge barrage, a deep undersea explosion could be heard, bigger than any depth charge. Oil and air bubbles boiled to the surface. The Patterson had found its mark. After that day, the most important submarine in the history of the state of Oregon, the Imperial Japanese Navy's I-25, was never heard from again. Actually, you could argue that the USS Blueback is historically more important because of the generations of youngsters who have toured it while visiting OMSI, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry in Portland. But you get the idea. I-25 was one of the large fleet submarines that the Japanese Navy put out to sea during the war, a Type B cruiser sub. Imperial Japanese Type Bs were big, among the very largest in regular service throughout the war, 357 feet long, and displacing just over 3,700 tons of seawater. For weaponry, they packed 17 of Japan's legendary Long Lance torpedoes, a 140mm deck gun, that's 5.5 inch, a pair of 25mm anti-aircraft guns, and a small scouting seaplane kept disassembled in a waterproof hangar on the deck. The reason I-25 is so important to Oregon stems from two visits it paid to the Beaver State in the year before it sank. In the course of those events, the I-25 sank two merchant ships, shelled a coastal battery, and sent its airplane ashore to try to start a forest fire. It left Oregon not much worse for wear, but the psychological effect was considerable as Oregonians wondered if this were just the beginning and realized that if it was, they'd be right on the front lines. It wasn't, of course, the beginning of anything. It was just a single submarine, a single, very busy submarine. The I-25 left Yokosuka, Japan in the spring of 1942 and headed east across the Pacific Ocean, headed for Alaska and Point South. This was the big submarine's third combat patrol and would be its second visit to the American West Coast. On the first visit, just a few weeks after Pearl Harbor, the plan had been to heave to off the mouth of the Columbia River on December 25th, unlimber the deck gun, and give the Americans as many 140mm Christmas presents as possible. This plan had been scotched at the last minute, much to the crew's disappointment. The reason given was that there were so many combat patrols being flown in the area that it just wasn't worth the risk of losing the Imperial Navy's only scouting presence off the northwest coast for what would likely be nothing more than a symbolic gesture. That decision may have had something to do with an interesting coincidence in the record. On December 24th, 1941, Everett Brick Holstrom was flying his B-25 Mitchell bomber low over the mouth of the Columbia when he unexpectedly saw, loafing there in the sea below, a surface Japanese submarine. Brick Holstrom, as you may remember if you're a World War II buff, was one of the Doolittle Raiders who bombed Tokyo in April 1942. In late December 1941, he was based out of Pendleton and was training with his team for that raid. You may also recognize his name if you're a Beaver. He's possibly the most decorated Oregon State University alumnus in college history. Silver Star, Legion of Merit, 2 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 5 Air Medals, 2 Commendation Medals. He retired from the Air Force in 1969 at the rank of Brigadier General. So I'm just going to stipulate that his word can probably be trusted on this. If Brick Holstrom says he saw a Japanese submarine, Brick Holstrom saw a Japanese submarine. And the reason I say that is because anytime someone claims to have seen a Japanese submarine off the Pacific coast, and especially in the Oregon area, they're in the company of folks like L. Ron Hubbard, who claimed to have bombed one. There were a number of sightings. Most of them were not real. This one probably was. Ordering his bombardier to get the payload ready, Holmstrom lined up and let the sub have it, laying down a string of three bombs as he roared by overhead. The resulting explosion nearly knocked the B-25 out of the sky, and Holmstrom believed he'd hit his mark. The crew backed him up, and the Army Air Corps gave him one of his air medals for this action. The Imperial Japanese Navy did not lose any submarines off the Columbia in late 1941, but it most definitely did have a submarine stationed in the area, a submarine that was scheduled to shell the Cape Disappointment Light the following day, but which unexpectedly decided that it had better not. Was it the I-25 that Holmstrom saw? Did his bombs maybe bracket the big sub, and by the time he got turned around to see what had happened, it had submerged and he thought he'd sunk it? It seems very logical. If so, this would be more than a little bit ironic, because Holmstrom and his fellow Doolittle Raiders would go on 4 months later to do something that would inspire Submariner pilot Nobu Fujita to launch his plan to bomb America with his submarine-launched fold-up float plane later in 1942, launched from the same submarine. That something, of course, was the Pendleton-based Doolittle Raid on Tokyo. But Fujita's raid on the forest near Brookings wouldn't take place until the I-25's fourth cruise, and that, along with Fujita's bombing raid itself, is a story for another time. For now, we're mostly interested in the third cruise, which sallied forth from Yokosuka, where it had put into dry dock for a refit in April, just after the Doolittle raid. In fact, while the sub was in Yokosuka, Doolittle's raiders had another crack at it. Their bombs damaged the submarine and the dry dock slipped next to it. The I-25 set out from Yokosuka shortly after that raid, headed for Alaska and points south. 2 months and one heavily damaged Canadian freighter later, on the night of June 21, 1942, the sub was headed for the mouth of the Columbia River. The plan was to finally get those long-delayed Christmas presents delivered. The sub's captain, Meiji Tagami, waited until early evening when a large flotilla of fishing vessels was on its way in to shore. He brought the submarine, presumably running at periscope depth, right into the middle of the group. Tagami knew the fish boats would show him the way through any minefields that might have been laid there, and any airplanes would be far less likely to spot the big sub in the middle of a group of obviously harmless targets. When the sub got within range, Tagami brought the sub to the surface with its deck pointed seaward so that it could scamper away to safety if things got sticky. Sailors scrambled out and got ready for action. The deck gun was deployed and limbered up and ready to make history. The first and to date the only direct attack on the Beaver State by a wartime enemy, other than in the Civil War, of course, was about to commence. We'll talk about how that went and how the garrison at Fort Stevens responded in tomorrow's podcast, part two of this two-part presentation. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 700 stories originally created and published as newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Other Offbeat Oregon goodies include an active Facebook page, a ton of historic photos, and a bunch more stuff, including visuals for today's show and full citations to sources, all accessible through our hub page at offbeatoregon.com. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.